Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star and then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Melina, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop for caregivers coping with a loved one's cancer during the holidays. And we know that the holidays pose really enormous challenges for caregivers, and this program is for all of you on the call today, and we hope that you'll really find it very helpful. We have on the program today over 614 participants on the call, and you come from all over the United States. And you come from all different regions of the United States. And you come from big cities, little cities, and rural areas. And we also have international participants today from Canada, Malaysia, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So you really are a group of people globally from all over the world in many ways. Today's program is also a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and a number of other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you for the call today. Now, today's program was made possible with support from ASI Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of this very special program. And I also want to thank Geneva Lenze, actually, who's been very supportive of this program for many, many years. It's such an important program to offer. And I also want to mention to all of you that you did get materials from Cancer Care. And in those materials, there is information about the speakers. There is lots of information, resources about all of the different organizations that have partnered with us to make the program possible. And there also is an evaluation form. And I would ask you to take a moment at the end of the program today and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics and the programs you'd like us to offer going forward? I mean, this has been a topic that many of you have requested over and over again, and we've been able to offer it to you and really to shine a light on the needs of caregivers. And so take a moment, complete that evaluation form and send it back to us, and allows us to get a sense of really what you think about the program and what you'd like us to do in the future as well. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker is Dr. Laurel Northouse. Dr. Northouse is Mary Lou Willard French Professor of Nursing, University of Michigan School of Nursing. She is co-director of Sociobehavior Program, University of Michigan Comprehensive Cancer Center. And Dr. Northouse is going to really talk about a definition of what is a caregiver. What about taking on this role of caregiver and caring for your loved one with cancer? I'm now going to turn the program over to Dr. Northouse.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, for inviting me to be on the telephone workshop today. As you mentioned, I'm going to first talk about who is the caregiver and then about taking on the role. And then, as you said, just talk about caring for your loved one. I'd like to share a few things that we've learned from our own work with families facing cancer. But let's start by defining who is a caregiver. Well, in general, a caregiver is anyone who provides physical or emotional support to a person with cancer without pay. And that's kind of the critical part that distinguishes the family caregiver from a formal nurse or physician-type caregiver. But some people have a narrow view of the word caregiver, and they think of the caregiver only as a person who maybe lives with a survivor or who provides physical care. But in healthcare, we think of the term caregiver more broadly, and that includes anyone who is the primary support person to the survivor. So caregivers can be spouses, partners, adult children, siblings, friends, or even neighbors. It really can be a person who shares the same home with the survivor or who lives far away, as will be discussed later on our call. Some of you who are family members or friends who are listening in on the call today may not think of yourselves as a caregiver. Instead, you may think of yourselves as simply a family member or as a friend who cares about your loved one and who wants to help him or her in any way that you can. So you may not see yourself as anything special, but rather as someone doing something anyone would do for a person they cared about. So even though some of you may not identify with the term caregiver, I want to point out that caregiver is really a positive term, and it's taken on new importance in healthcare in the past several years. So many health professionals now recognize that family caregivers play a major role in helping cancer patients cope with the cancer. Many studies now refer to family members as the long-term care provider. I don't know if any of you have heard that term, but what it does is it stresses the importance and the long-term role that family caregivers play. And I think the other reason why people have been called long-term caregivers or long-term providers of care is that most of the people with cancer that I know and that you probably know get their day-to-day support or care from their family members and friends and not from health professionals. So we know from many research studies that cancer survivors who have a major support person or who I will call the family caregiver when they're dealing with cancer, they have less emotional distress and often recover faster from their illness than those who don't. But research also indicates that it's not always easy to be a caregiver, as many of you out there may know. Family caregivers often have emotional distress of their own, and sometimes their distress is as high as the patient's distress. I'm sure that doesn't surprise some of you. Caregivers can also become physically and mentally fatigued as they try to carry out their own work and family responsibilities and at the same time help their loved one. And the holiday seasons can be very difficult for caregivers. They often find they have too much to do, too little time to get things done. And the other thing is caregivers during this time can experience a pileup of demands. This pileup of tasks can seem overwhelming at times, can wear caregivers out, or make them feel irritable or more tired than usual. But it's very important for people who are the primary support person to take care of themselves so they can maintain their own health and still be effective providing care. So let's shift just for a few minutes to talk about taking on the role of caregiver, and I'd like to give you a few guidelines about that. Well, people can become caregivers in a variety of ways. Sometimes they ease into the role, and other times they are suddenly thrown into the role with no warning or preparation. But no matter how they become the primary support person, it's important for caregivers to keep a few of these following guidelines in mind. I just identified a few as I was thinking about our call today. First, try to get information to help you feel more prepared for your caregiving role. It's really helpful if you can go to a doctor's appointment with your loved one, as this will help you get firsthand information about the cancer and the treatments for it. Also, attending appointments will give you the opportunity to ask questions. You know, many times we get filtered information through the person who has cancer, but if you can go yourself, you can get firsthand information and also get a chance to get any kind of feedback that would be helpful to you. Second, get support for yourself. Some caregivers think they need to devote all their time to their loved one with cancer, and that's not realistic nor healthy. It's important for you to continue relationships with your family and friends so you don't feel isolated and get burned out. If you need someone to talk to and everyone around you is busy, especially during this holiday time, I would even encourage you to call Cancer Care and talk with their excellent social workers about your situation and ways to cope. You know, sometimes just sharing your own worries with a good listener will help you feel better. I also want to point out that you may need to ask for help yourself rather than assume that others will know you need support. It's common for people to think that only the cancer survivor needs support and not the family members or the family caregivers. So you really do need to let people know what your needs are. And third, I would just like to say that it's normal to feel overwhelmed at times as you take on a caregiving role. If you feel stressed out, don't blame yourself and don't blame your loved one, because illness can take a lot out of both of you. Rather, recognize that providing help may take more time and energy than you realized. Go easy on yourself and don't expect yourself to be a perfect caregiver. And I also would encourage you to recognize that caregiving is a process. It takes time to learn, like any other important thing in our life. So once again, be reasonable in terms of what you expect from yourself. So in the few minutes I have left, I just want to say a few words about caring for your loved one and share a couple of things we've learned from our work with families facing cancer. One of the most important things we've learned is that families need to try to work together as a team to deal with the stress of cancer. It's important that both you and your loved one try to work together, and even though you may see things differently. We know from the research that cancer patients and their family caregivers have a mutual effect on one another. So if you think about that for a minute, when the survivor is stressed out, it affects the caregiver. Likewise, when the caregiver is stressed out, it affects the survivor. That's why it's important for both of you to support each other, because you're really in this together, and each of you is affected by the illness. Also, try to keep the lines open in terms of your communication. I was just looking at some research findings we had the other day, and what we found is that some of the non-spouse caregivers have a more difficult time keeping up the communication with their loved one than do the spouse caregivers. So I would really encourage those people who aren't living with the survivor to keep that in mind, maybe make a little bit more effort to try to have regular communication. And finally, I would just like to say we've also learned from families that it's important to try not to let the cancer consume you, even though it could. Try to find pleasant activities or events that may give you a break from thinking about cancer all of the time. You know, holidays can be tricky to find a balance between going out and or deciding to stay in. And so if you can try to identify an event or two that may be relaxing where you can be yourself, but you don't need to put on a happy face when you're not feeling well, that may be the situation to consider. But really do encourage you to evaluate that. I know some of my other panel members are going to touch on that topic as well. And I think I'm going to stop for now and turn it back to Dr. Messner.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Northhouse. Wonderful, wonderful presentation, wonderful overview of caregiving and some of the issues and some really helpful tips for people to keep in mind as well. And the next presenter is Dr. Sarah Auchincloss. Dr. Auchincloss is Associate Attending Psychiatrist, New York Presbyterian Hospital, New York Weill Cornell Medical Center, Consultant in Psychiatry, Memorial Hospital, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Auchincloss is going to cover coping with the stress of caregiving during the holidays and managing family, friends, partners, and traditions. And I now turn the program over to Dr. Auchincloss.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'd like to say that I'm grateful to have been asked to be part of this panel. The holidays. What is harder about caregiving at the holidays? I decided, thinking about this, to try to break this down into as close as I could get to its elemental components, and this is how it seemed to me. The holidays, as we know, are a special designated time of transition. They're recognized in many different ways, culturally and spiritually, around the world, often having something to do with closeness to the winter solstice. And in many parts of the world, it's colder and darker then, and that changes how things seem and creates physical adversity, too. So there's really nothing like dealing with snowstorms, airports, road conditions, and physical risk to other people you care about and love on top of caregiving hour by hour for someone who's already sick, whom you love. That's part of the holiday experience. It's a time when all of our awarenesses are intensified. What's going on? What's good? What's bad? It's as if life is illuminated by a bright, hot firelight against a deeply darker backdrop. Strong contrasts abound. People tend to look around. They take stock of their lives over time at this time of year, the past, the present, the future. And they're deeply grateful for what they have, or they try to be grateful. But that Scrooge sensation, that just humbug sensation, is often very strong, too. So both awarenesses may be quite vivid simultaneously, and that creates an intense inner mental state that both strengthens and depletes the caregiver simultaneously, too. And as the year ends, all of anyone's previous major gains and losses come to mind. And so for the family with illness, the current losses, too, are highlighted. Of health, of the ability perhaps to be independent or to make a familiar contribution at this time of year, like cooking or singing. When someone's sick, he or she may not be able to attend the usual holiday and family gatherings and may be able to do much less. And we all understand that this is sad partly because the purpose of these gatherings is to give people the strength of human connection and the comfort of familiar rituals. So the person who needs it the most may be the least able to participate. And caregivers also must forego the needed refueling or get less of it sometimes. And in response to that, the familiar patterns must be adapted or changed, often in pretty major ways, to include the sick person and the caregiver whenever possible. And it's normal to experience these big changes, which are happening in a time already of intense awareness and very familiar tradition. These changes are experienced as very difficult, even when they're absolutely necessary. Though often there are small and not so small good surprises in the mix too. Again, I just want to emphasize it's normal for everyone to have strong reactions to these changes. Around any illness situations, all family members might have a real upwelling of grief, or it might take the form of anger or a desire to isolate oneself or to be controlling or to try to act as if nothing is different at all. But people of all ages may also be unexpectedly generous or be able to grow or be close in ways that hadn't been seen before. Or they may find a whole new vein of humor in how things are evolving that just casts a whole different light on the situation. These reactions can vary a lot, and they can be another factor for the caregiver to deal with in others and in him or herself. This is all especially challenging coming after often months of the work and depletion of caregiving. So the calm person explodes, but maybe the silent person starts telling stories. Everyone's remembering the past holiday times while experiencing and getting through this one. And it's a good chance to focus at times on ways to get closer to what's important. A gathering itself may be adapted or made simpler so that the sick person can be present at least for some part of it. Or the gathering may go on as usual or maybe some distance away and the person must miss part or all of it and be missed by everyone. And meanwhile, those closest to the sick person will often create some smaller moments of holiday expression in any way they can, in the hospital or at home or in some other setting. This can be a challenge. You'll need to be flexible and creative insofar as possible. And I think everyone listening has had some experience of the sort of pull the rabbit out of the hat type of challenge of creating a small, good holiday moment for someone who's a long way from the things they've loved the most. And I would just underline, doing this, the usual guidelines apply. Keep it simple. Ask for help. And hold on to your sense of humor. It can help to take a moment to reflect on what's most important about the holiday for a particular family or a particular person. To try to do things differently, but include some part of the most important traditional elements for that person or family. What music or songs or candles or colors, what food or drink is the best part, is the favorite, or could bring a taste of the season to the loved one and to the caregiver. What picture, and I would add in here, what use of technology, using Skype to get a face to someone, a voice. What action conveys best the feeling that needs to get across? Sometimes we do our best work when we have to summarize. For the caregiver, then, the holidays are a really demanding time of transition and tradition involving the family and the cultural surround and the spiritual part of life. And it's a time that arises during the longer running, ongoing, hour by hour, day by day transition and work of illness that already involves the family so deeply. So on a bad day, you might feel it's a seasonal crisis that's plopped on top of the illness crisis. One is determined by the calendar and the other by chance. And on a good day, the holidays can provide at least a welcome distraction or the gathering of greater support around the illness situation. The special intense feelings around both illness and these powerful seasonal traditions can blend and collide in ways that create unexpected insight and closeness, changes in old patterns for the good, and keen awareness of what is important. And these can be among the strongest experiences we can have in life. So taking the moment to give one's mind, one's heart and soul, one's body, the chance to absorb these experiences, to reflect, to regain balance, and gain strength from them can make caregiving at the holidays more meaningful and worthwhile, despite the extra demands we already understand and accept as part of this time in life. And I would like to stop there and welcome questions at the end.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Auchincloss, for an excellent and very eloquent presentation and really covering all the different issues that people might be struggling with. And our next speaker is Dr. Lupe Palos. And Dr. Palos is Clinical Research Manager, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, Division of Medical Affairs, Department of Cancer Survivorship. And Dr. Palos is going to cover actually long-distance caregiving and tips for taking care of yourself. Dr. Palos?
And thank you, Carolyn, for the opportunity to be involved in the discussion of such an important topic. This is a topic that affects and involves the entire family during significant occasions such as our upcoming holidays. Dr. Northouse gave us an excellent definition of a caregiver and an understanding of some of the responsibilities that come with that role. Dr. Auchincloss followed that by educating us on how to cope with stress during the holidays and manage the challenges associated with being a caregiver during this time. As we heard, caregivers may often feel that they must keep up with the wonderful traditions their families have always associated with holiday celebrations. And like many of us, they often struggle to keep up with those traditions. However, in the midst of preparing for the holidays, families may also find themselves struggling to keep up with the caregiver activities when a loved one is diagnosed with cancer. Trying to maintain so many roles can be challenging for a caregiver who may live with the patient or survivor or live close enough to see their loved one on a daily basis. But what happens when there is a large geographic distance between the patient and their caregiver? What happens if the family finds that they are in a long-distance caregiving situation? Are the roles the same? How can a caregiver care for a loved one who lives in another city, state, or sometimes country? Is long-distance caregiving even possible? As one caregiver said to me, that cannot be done. How can you be a caregiver if you do not live with the person you're supposed to be caring for? Well, I'm positive that many of you listening on this call know exactly what I'm talking about. You are a long-distance caregiver. And in that role, you have a unique set of circumstances. But with preparation, planning, and preventive action, this experience can be a wonderful opportunity to develop new strategies, new traditions, and new memories across the miles for the holidays. I'm going to talk a little bit about these areas in my discussion, and then at the end I'll touch on how a caregiver may need to make some adjustments when trying to care for a loved one who lives far away from them. These are adjustments can be considered strategies that promote self-care. Self-care is critical when caregivers find themselves dealing with both long-distance caregiving and holiday celebrations. Let's begin with a question. What is long-distance caregiving? Let me ask those of you in this call to close your eyes for a moment and picture a loved one or a friend who may live in another part of your city, another state, or another country. What type of thoughts come into your mind? Do you wonder what they're doing at that moment? Do you wonder, are they healthy? or what new things are happening in their life. Is there a new baby, a new engagement, a new home? These are normal thoughts that enter our mind when we think of someone who lives a distance from us. Now shift that thought to think of someone that may live far from you and is ill. You may have the same questions, but now they are under the umbrella of concern for that ill person. During this brief exercise, you may have thought of your loved one who is living with cancer at this moment. And for those of you who live with or close to that individual, these questions can be answered just by walking across the room or getting in a car and driving a short distance to see them. But what about those of you who do not live in close proximity to your loved ones who are dealing with this cancer experience? What do you do? It's not so easy to walk across the room or drive that short distance, and that causes unique concerns, challenges, and circumstances for the caregiver, the patient or survivor, and the rest of the family. Now, for those of you who believe, like the caregiver I mentioned earlier, that you can't be a caregiver if you don't live with or close to the survivor, there is growing evidence that there are long-distance caregivers. We know that about 7 million caregivers are long-distance caregivers, and long-distance may mean living in a large metropolitan city where it takes an hour to drive between your home and that of your loved one diagnosed with cancer. So just imagine, if you have to take 2 hours per day to go back and forth, you multiply that times 7 days, that equals 14 hours per week. Well, you understand what I'm trying to say. That is long-distance caregiving. But what if you live on the West Coast and your family member lives on the East Coast? How do you care for them with those types of geographic distances between you? And who provides this care? Women, wives, daughters, sons, husbands, men? Well, in the past, the majority of caregivers have been women, but that's changing now, and at least 40% of caregivers are men. So for our discussion, I would like to propose a simple definition of who is a long-distance caregiver. It is a person who lives an hour or more away from the loved one who needs the care. Now, those of you who are caregivers know how complex the care may be, and many of you fill different roles as you provide the care, work full-time, and care for a family. And as we know by today's topic, an increasing number of caregivers are providing that help across the miles. There's no doubt that distance poses a barrier to caregiving, but there's growing evidence that even those who are long distance provide essential support to their loved one. Long distance caregivers provide advice, financial support, help with decision making, and are critical in providing short-term help during a crisis. These can be very rewarding experiences for the caregiver. But being a long-distance caregiver can also be challenging. Oftentimes, there may be feelings of frustration or guilt. For instance, there may be thoughts of, I wish I could do more. I'm not doing enough. Perhaps there is fear or uncertainty about the changes in their loved one's physical and mental health, and other similar thoughts. The combination of these thoughts may contribute to the stress and distress of the long-distance caregiver. In addition to these emotions, the roles and responsibilities of the caregiver will change throughout the cancer experience. So it's not surprising that as those roles change, the emotional and physical health of the long-distance caregiver will also change. Well, now that we recognize the circumstances, what can we do to be proactive long-distance caregivers? I'd like to share a few strategies that you can use when you find yourself or if you find yourself in this role. Here are 8 critical tips that will help you plan effectively, be proactive, and be prepared. Number 1, determine the roles of a family member or friend who wishes to be part of the team and that may live and who may live close to your loved one. Find out who's willing to help and what they can do. Find a team of care partners. And remember, there are many different interpretations of family, so you may not just have to rely on your nuclear family. Number 2, be kind to yourself. Determine realistically what can be done. Create a stable and realistic role for you as a long-distance caregiver. Number 3, be informed. Maintain close communication with the patient's physicians, providers, and helpers. Schedule a regular time to call them and talk with them. And at the same time, schedule a regular time to speak with your loved one. So that way you both have something to look forward to. Number 4, set up a safety net. Identify neighbors, friends, and other relatives that can help you monitor your loved one's condition. As one caregiver told me, let them be your eyes and ears. 5, you can keep a logbook where you record conversations with other caregivers, providers, or insurers that you speak to on the telephone. That helps you keep track of who you spoke to, when you spoke to them, and what the outcome was. 6, it would be helpful to keep a list of helpful numbers handy. Make a list and give that list to everyone that's involved in the care of your loved one. And keep copies for yourself nearby also. Number 7, if you can, book regular trips to your loved one's home ahead of time. Take advantage of some of those specials they may have during the holidays, but also just do it throughout the year. That also then will give you something to look forward to. And number 8, when you do visit your loved one's home, do your own assessment. You can look at the following areas. How's the personal hygiene of your loved one? What is their level of activity and mobility? Are their nutritional needs being met? Are there groceries in the pantry and refrigerator? What's the condition of the home? Is it clear and well organized? And what about the safety factors? Are there smoke detectors, secure locks on the doors? Does a trusted neighbor have a key to the house? And are there items clear so there won't be any falling hazards for that person? Knowing about these kinds of things will help you feel better and have a sense of security. These are ways to keep the connections open between you and your loved one and to share the precious holidays. In the last few moments, I'd like to share a few practical tips or self-care methods for being a successful long-distance caregiver. To help with your worries and your thoughts, set up a web camera so you can actually see your loved one and speak to them. We already heard that Skype is an awesome way to keep in touch with the loved one across the miles. Regular communication such as this may give you peace of mind. Prepare your own video clips of past holidays. Give a snapshot of memories from the past and share them with your loved one. So even if you're not there physically, you are there with them in spirit. Create new traditions, even if you cannot be there in person. Some of these other activities can become new traditions for you, your loved one, and your family members. Finally, and most important, keep tabs on your own physical and mental health. Encourage yourself as the caregiver, whether you live close or long distance, to take time for self-care. Remind yourself that by taking care of your own health, you and the person you are caring for will reap the benefits of being a healthy caregiver, even if it may be across the freeways, across the mountains, or across the oceans. My colleagues and I look forward to hearing from you and the suggestions you may have for caregivers and those they care for, whether in close proximity or across the miles. Thank you for allowing me to share these thoughts with you. Carolyn, this concludes my remarks, and now perhaps we can hear about some of the tips that our listeners have, because they're the experts in this area. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Palos. And, yes, we would now, for our second half of this program, we recognize that all of you on the call have tremendous expertise as caregivers. And so if there's some tips that have worked particularly well for you or that you would just like to share with everyone on the call, you know, please, we're going to ask Melina to tell you how to queue up. You certainly can ask a question if you wish to, but also please feel very much free to share a tip, something that you have found helpful that you want to share with our large audience today. Thank you. And Melina, could you explain to everybody how to go ahead and queue up?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a tip you wish to share or would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Mark D.
Hi. Not really a question, but just a tip that's been very helpful to get my wife through this this process. She's about halfway through chemo now, heading for radiation. I'm an oncology massage therapist, and all she really feels comfortable having is her feet rubbed. And this doesn't require much expertise. It just requires being mindful about pressure. And she says she gets the best night's sleep when I just rub her feet slowly, gently, carefully, mindfully, without a lot of conversation, with a little lotion. It's been extremely helpful to give her, to give her the mind and a better night's sleep. And also some time for us to share together without a lot of agenda.
What a wonderful tip that is, Mark. Thank you for sharing that. That's really wonderful. Thank you. And that is terrific. And do any of our speakers want to comment on that wonderful tip?
Well, I think what strikes me about what Mark has said is he's found a very simple way of providing physical support to his partner. And I think sometimes we think we have to do something fancy or complicated, but his example just shows how meaningful a very simple use of touch or massage can be.
And another important point that he said, it's that they had no planned agenda at that time, that it was just simply that they were enjoying each other's company and the time they were spending with each other. Lots of times I think caregivers and their loved ones get so caught up in what they have to do that they lose track of the importance of such moments.
That's wonderful, and it really is the concept of something so practical that you're letting everybody know. This is wonderful. And I will take our next comment or tip from our next person.
Our next question or tip comes from Elise S.
Yes, hi. I enjoyed the presentation so far, and I found the comment that it takes time to learn to be a caregiver a very interesting comment, because my husband was diagnosed a year ago with acute myeloid leukemia, and in that time he has been in the hospital on and off for about 75 days, the most time being up at Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa, Florida for a bone marrow transplant. And this being the year anniversary of his diagnosis, I had felt that a burden would have been lifted from my shoulders that my husband is still here. His bone marrow transplant was successful, and for the most part he's doing fairly well. But yet I feel more overwhelmed than I felt even at the beginning with the diagnosis and being away for 110 days in Tampa, Florida, where I live in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, so it was really uprooting myself. And I was wondering if that's a normal process in the caregiving process to feel more overwhelmed. I know some people have commented that I'm, you know, now having a chance to reflect on what I had to go through for the whole year, and I had adrenaline rushes and just knew I had to get things done. And now I have a little bit more time, although I am finding it difficult because being home actually has been harder because the doctors and things that he has to have are further away than when I was up in Tampa. So I was wondering if any of the doctors could comment on the fact that I feel more overwhelmed at this point in the stage of being a caregiver for a year now.
Excellent. Elise, that's an excellent, really, your observations and just what you're saying is so important, and many people feel that way. Dr. Auchincloss, can you comment on that?
I think this is a completely normal reaction. I call this just a delayed reaction because I think when people are dealing with diagnosis, choosing a team, starting treatment, going through treatment, ups and downs of treatment, they manage to do it. We all manage to do things like this because we shut down partway in a way that we may not even be aware of a fair amount of the time. And it is often when things get better and when treatment is wrapping up that the signals from the oncology world are great, you know, throw some confetti in the air, you look like you're closer to done with treatment. But for the patient and for the caregiver, there is often a feeling of being just sandbagged by all the feelings that you could not have while you were going through the process of diagnosis and treatment itself. And there is an enormous amount of work to do of reconnecting with, you know, normal life, everything from, you know, getting dog food into the house to finding out what's been going on in your kids' classes to dealing with the actual status of the house itself. And there is enormous amount of work, and it is normal for people to feel very daunted. In fact, I think people often have a real low that they don't see coming and isn't. To be honest, I don't think the oncology world sort of sees that as being so important because it happens after treatment ends a lot of the time. But for those of us who work with survivors and families, it's really an important transition. People have a real dip right in the time zone that you're in. You will come through this. You are going to figure out gradually, may take months, how to sort of juggle things in this new configuration. So be patient with yourself. Continue to ask for help, and just try to be trying to be understanding with yourself about what it is you've accomplished coming through this year as well as your husband. And I'm open to thoughts from the other panelists and from the audience.
Thank you. Dr. Palos, Dr. Northhouse?
Well, I just agree very much with the comments that Dr. Auchincloss has made. I think the only other thing that just came into my mind that Elise mentioned was feeling isolated. And many caregivers and survivors, patients, talk about that as well. Once they move away from the healthcare team, kind of that security that they can quickly call someone, they're around, they really can feel on their own, and that's kind of a scary feeling and also a threatening feeling because you don't want to do anything wrong and you're not exactly sure what might pop up or what to be concerned about. But I would just say it certainly it would be appropriate if on those days you're feeling isolated or worried to check in with the healthcare staff that you had met with previously, just if you have simple questions or just want to give a report that's most appropriate.
I agree with that. One of the things that one of the nurses has shared with me, the social worker shared with me, is that they also encourage family members and survivors to use email to communicate with their team. That's one of the new technology ways because many of them have an email address or account when they're going through their treatment. And so that's what another way that you can try to communicate and maintain that connection with that with the team that you left behind.
Excellent. Wow, this is really, so Elise, thank you. This really, really, these are so, such important points that you've raised and our speakers have addressed it. Thank you. And we have some other tips or comments, and other members of the audience may also want to add to this as well. Melina?
Our next question or tip comes from Colleen R.
Good afternoon, everyone. I want to thank the four speakers for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us and give us some hints and tips. I did have a tip. I'm new to this. My mom was just diagnosed the week of Halloween, and she's had her first of six chemos. I come from a very long line of very strong-willed, steel magnolia-type women. So my first thought was to just take charge, take over, you know, of everything and take control of it so she could just rest. And I found that to be incredibly wrong. She wants to go through this with me. So my tip is if there's anyone out there that wants to just take care of everything, take over, take control of it, you really need to take the time to stop and listen to what the person that is going through it feels, such as I offered to do all of her Christmas shopping for her this year. I said, I'll be your personal shopper, make a list, I'll go everywhere, I'll do everything, I'll wrap it, I'll do your cards, so on and so forth. And she never responded after four requests. And then last week when I said, how about if I take Friday off and we go shopping together? And we take plenty of water. We take a lot of breaks. We take food. We ride the little mechanical cart when we go to the stores. And she jumped on it. So I guess that's just my whole point, is just take time to hear what they want to do and try not to take charge.
Oh, Colleen, that's wonderful. Thank you so much. And I'm going to just ask if any of our speakers want to comment on that. That's just such a, you know, these are such pearls of wisdom we're hearing here, really so helpful tips to everybody.
I think it goes back to that process of learning how to be a caregiver. That's very wise information that you shared with all of us. It definitely would give your mom a sense of decision-making. She's got a say-so in what's going on. And especially, like you said, if she's been a strong-will, steel magnolia type of person, it's probably very difficult for her to change that relationship for herself, her perception of herself.
Fantastic.
I agree. I just want to, with Dr. Palos as well, is that I think it's important for people who are diagnosed with cancer to keep their identity as people who are able to function and still do things even though they might be exhausted or tired from their chemo treatments. But I think, Colleen, you've done a wonderful job of being sensitive to your mother's concerns, and when you saw it wasn't working, you modified your approach and came up with a joint effort for the two of you. So I think that was really a wonderful idea.
Absolutely.
Really, really is an amazing group here, I must say. This is an amazing call. Should we take our next tip or comment?
Our next question or tip comes from Kimberly P.
Hi. I just wanted to share this. My
My father was a caregiver for my mother, who has Alzheimer's. She did not have cancer, but caregiving is caregiving, no matter what disease or, you know, you're dealing with. But one thing that I wanted to share, I have become one of the caregivers now. My father was the sole caregiver. And one thing that I learned accidentally, it came back to me, I learned to show appreciation for the caregiver, because the caregiver can become, can feel very isolated and feel like no one knows what they're going through and what sacrifices they have made to become the caregiver. And something that I would do whenever I was at the house, I would go out beforehand and buy a card. And then I would slip into my dad's room and put the card on the pillow, on his pillow. And I would just thank him for taking such good care of my mother and letting him know that I thought the world of him and what a hero he was in my eyes. And I would do this occasionally throughout the years. And my father, as a caregiver, unexpectedly passed away in his caregiving role. And when I went into his room and was going through his things, I found every single one of those cards. And they were all together, and that made me realize that he, it meant a lot to him to receive those. So we need to, you know, really think about the caregivers and show them appreciation. And it can be something as simple as just a card, but it means the world to them.
Oh, Kimberly, that is so amazing what you've just shared. We're so sorry about your dad, but what you described in terms of just his, all those cards, what they meant to him, and that you actually reached out and really wanted to give him support. Thank you so much, and thank you for sharing this. Do any of our speakers want to add to this wonderful just?
Well, I have a thought, which is I think it helps to thank people more than you do in the busy run of normal life. I just think everyone around a situation like this feels how hard it is and is providing whatever contribution they're providing despite how hard it is. And everyone benefits from being thanked. To call this the practice of gratitude, it's part of the survival mechanisms that get people through, I think, is to show your gratitude as much as you can to everyone around you, which constantly means reminding yourself to do that, because, you know, we all get preoccupied in these situations and very focused on the next task that needs to be done. And yet to remind yourself to be grateful and appreciative, I think it smooths the situation a little bit. And people, I do think, really need that and are grateful for the recognition, even if they make nothing of it that you can see or sort of act like it's nothing. It's still a good practice.
And I'd just like to follow up on my colleague's comments that I believe that what happens is we get so caught up in the doing that we sometimes forget about that practice of gratitude. I love that, the wording of that. And maybe that needs to be up on the refrigerator or written on a piece of paper or a card that we can look at so we can remember that. And I think it's just the acknowledgement that someone is being recognized for their effort. And again, even if they don't react to it or say anything, it's in their heart. And so that really helps them then to continue with what they have to do.
Well, I just want to chime in a minute and say to thank Kimberly for such a wonderful idea.
Yeah.
It's so concrete, and so many people can use your idea and is feeling not helpless, but something they can do. And I just want to build off your comment. In addition to appreciation, another point along that line is to identify strengths that you might see the caregiver do. You know, sometimes caregivers don't think they're doing such a good job, or they may feel inadequate or whatever. And if somebody else, maybe another family member or friend, says to that person, boy, you really did a nice job of taking, you know, mom out that day, or it was really, you really have kind of a knack to make her laugh, even though we're all been kind of down. But just to point out a strength that you've observed can help a caregiver feel like they actually are doing a relatively good job, at least at that point that you observed it.
And Kimberly, you know, we all want to collectively thank you, because you too are a caregiver. And so you have been very diligent in thanking, you know, you're very specifically trying to thank your dad and help out. But you are a caregiver, and we want to thank you for all that you've done, not only in terms of your own family situation, but also on this call today in terms of just helping everybody who heard what you said and shared and provide this practical information. So we want to be sure to thank you as well. This is just amazing. I have to say this is a most amazing group, all of you, but I want to thank you very much, Kimberly. Thank you. And so we want you to kind of, if we could all, if you could hear all of our applause for each of you, it's there. So thank you. And our next tip or comment?
Our next question or tip comes from Karen T.
Yes. My mother was a 15-year breast cancer survivor. And I just wanted to comment that toward the end of her life, her last year was a difficult year for her. But up to 3 days before her death, she was still playing games with friends and driving and taking care of her 11-year-old granddaughter when she could. And I have to say that we developed a relationship that was wonderful. And I know many of you probably have done this, but just a comment that we need to remember to do things in their own time. We had a special way of bedding her down at night, and we'd start at 9 o'clock, follow her routine, and by 11:15, she'd had her bath, and she'd had her lotion and whatever, a little snack, and then she'd use her oxygen for about 20 minutes or so before she was ready to bed down. She didn't want to become dependent on it. So we did use it to give her the benefit, but didn't insist it stay on. And then by 11:15, she was ready to go to sleep. And so I would leave at that time and let her have her time to herself. And she happened to be in the hospital at that time, of course. But I have to also comment that when she permanently closed her eyes, it was 11:15 p.m.
Oh, so she did this exactly at the time.
It was our time.
Your time.
It was our time, yes. Wow. But we did it all in her time.
How amazing that you're able to do that, Karen. That is quite amazing that you really, as a family, and as that you all really work with your mom. And I think you also talk about really long-term caregiving here, too, which we haven't really touched on a whole lot. And you really did this for a very long time, providing the very best care for your mom possible and being as sensitive as you could be to her needs, which is really amazing. I thank you for that. And I'm going to ask if any of our other speakers want to comment on just all that you've done and what you shared with us.
Well, I also hear patience in your story and in your voice as you were describing your mother's situation, knowing that it took you a couple of hours to help your mother relax and get ready for bed, and it doesn't sound at all that you rushed the situation, but you recognized it was a very important time for both of you. So it sounds like you did a wonderful job of attending to your mother.
Thank you, Karen. It's just, and I think we're all going to remember what each of you have said, because they're very powerful that you're sharing with each of us. And our next, Melina?
Our next question or tip comes from Mark D.
Yes, I was triggered by the comment by the person who called in who comes from a line of steel magnolias. My wife is a titanium magnolia. and likes to be sure she's in charge of everything all the time, including her comings and goings, her cancer care, as well as her job. She's holding the job right now in order to maintain the benefits so she can pay for this. And she's regarded by the family as one who is always the one to go to solve problems, make decisions, set schedules, and set priorities and run the party. Well, she's trying to maintain this and does pretty well, although it fatigues her greatly, and it is taking its toll on her. And as I try, I know better than to try to take charge. I am here available at her beck and call and doing whatever it takes to help her feel comfortable and get through this with the least amount of stress. But I can see it's causing her stress, and she's had a couple of pretty serious meltdowns where she's just lost it. And I know that this is a result of having suppressed all of the stress reaction that she's been facing. And so this is causing stress for me, seeing her load up and load up and load up and then lose it. She is taking steps to she's taking steps to de-stress. She reads a lot and is doing some qigong things, and that's helpful. Qigong, you know, or it's Chinese exercises. I'd like to have a little support so that I can be enough help without being overbearing, and also be more sensitive to things that I need to do to lighten her load and help her get through this without thinking she has to get through. It's almost like she's trying to get through it by herself. Mm-hmm. I feel quite dispensable much of the time and quite mm-hmm. unnecessary. So I just stand by and wait for the next need to show up. Often she identifies it, or sometimes I do. But I want to give enough care without getting in her way.
That sounds very much, Mark, as if you're quite essential here. And actually, perhaps all of us would want to kind of comment about just how important you are here, and maybe things that can be done to actually help you in this situation as well, because it sounds like you're really doing everything you can to be helpful to your wife. And any comments from our speakers?
I just want to acknowledge also that your presence is there, and you're very insightful to know when to say something and when not to say something. So that, I believe, will, you know, helps your wife and supports her quite a bit. One of the things that happens, I believe, when someone has been seen as the strong person in the family is that the other family members don't always know how to react when that type of situation comes up. Some of them may just say, well, you know, she's always done it, and she doesn't look like she wants to give it up, so we'll let her keep on doing it. Others may think, well, you know, if this gives her, you know, something to look forward to, or some kind of something to that she appreciates and likes, well, we'll let her do it. So sometimes what you just need to do is sit down with some of the family members and just explain, this is what I've noticed, this is what I see, you know, can we do something to relieve her of some of the things that she's having to do? And so, you know, with the family conference like that, then people can identify certain things that they can do, so your wife won't feel that she has to be the one that has to be in charge all the time. And I'm sure my colleagues have some other ways and strategies that they could help with that type of situation.
Thank you, Dr. Taylor. Yes?
Well, I would just like to say, I think another a point to add on is that clearly how she's dealing with some of these issues is having an effect on you. And if it's possible for the two of you to sit down together when you aren't under a huge amount of stress and just talk about how each of you are being affected by the illness and how you're trying to manage the many demands on your time, and maybe to share with her your concern for her when she things build up and she has a meltdown, and also just to be say that it's hard for you as well, and that you want to both work to try to have things go as smoothly as possible, and what are some of the things that you could both give a little on to try to work together to deal with some of the changes you're going through.
And I would just put in that I think strong people raise their own set of issues. I have nicknames for everything, as you're noticing. I call this problems of strong people.
One of the problems of strong people is they're very bad at asking for help, partly because they got all invested in being a strong person, and it works 99.9% of the time till they hit something like this. And then when they do feel they're asking for help, the signal they send is often not really read by the people around them, sometimes because it's a nearly imperceptible signal, like it's tiny, or because they're sending a signal, but they're still sending the other signals of, like, I'm fine and I can deal with it. And so people feel they're getting a mixed signal and they're a little slow to jump. So I think what you're doing by staying real close and observing is the essential job of the partner of a strong person. They're not good at putting into words. So if you can learn how to put things into words, that would be a huge stride. You know, what she needs, but she may show it nonverbally or vibe you, and I think she is probably counting heavily on your nearness and your attunedness to pick up the signals when she starts hitting the limits of what she's capable of carrying. I think strong people do that a lot. I think they tend to communicate non-verbally when they are beginning to feel a need. And then another thing I think they do, I've been very close to a number of them, and these are familiar issues, is they will turn down the first two or three offers of help. And part of your job is to persist and gently, or just gently step in and non-verbally while your mouth is saying, I understand, I know you want to do this on your own, but your hand is, you know, just gently picking up the washcloth they can't get, and you are helping them wash themselves. It's a way of saying, I respect you as someone who wants so badly to be independent, but I'm also going to just practically meet the need here. And what you're doing may feel like this is not enough. I don't get to take action much, but your nearness is something she's drawing strength from. And and also it provides you're close enough to catch her nonverbal signals when she does start sending them, and that is probably how she's going to signal at first, I would guess. So you just stay put, and you get the gold star, forgetting that that is your job. And I've certainly worked with a lot of women who are sick and not, and they, you know, being taken care of by men who may have loved them to the heavens, but didn't really know how to take care of them and had a lot of trouble, you know, mastering basic caretaking skills. That's how the culture, you know, how we raise our men is not to be caretakers so much. So you're doing a great job. You just hang in there.
And that's such a true thing, really, for Mark. And we want to give gold star to everybody on this call today. You've just been, we just want to give everybody a round of applause. I want to thank our speakers, but I also want to thank all of you who've really, really joined in this call today and really offered tips or asked questions, just really been very generous in kind of participating in the call today. I do want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour program and that although our program will end soon, I want to remind you that you can access all these services from Cancer Care, and those will continue way beyond when the program ends. They continue endlessly for all of you. Now, Cancer Care is simply a phone call away, or if you prefer to go online and visit us on our website, you can do that as well. But we have a staff of 60 master's-level trained oncology social workers who are here to provide a host of services to you. And they're here to actually offer you someone to talk to. So just if you're feeling like, oh, I need someone to talk to, they're here to talk just to you about your concerns. We're also here to provide practical and financial assistance as well. We have lots of materials, and we do lots of these type of workshops as well on the telephone that you can participate in, or you can listen to previous programs on the telephone or online as podcasts. And so we basically are here for you. And perhaps most importantly at this time of the year, but all throughout the year, I don't want anyone to leave this call feeling that you are alone. I want you to now feel that you're part of a community of support and that we are here for you each step of the way. And we certainly do, please do feel free to call us. Our 800 number is 1-800-813-HOPE. So we're simply a telephone call away, or you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org. And I, again, just want to thank all of you. And I think you just are, this has probably been one of the most amazing calls we've ever provided. You've been all quite extraordinary. And we hope to offer many more programs like this. So thank you all, and have a very fine day. Thank you. And a very fine holiday time as well.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a wonderful day.